are going to talk about insurance now, and I give the floor to Andrea.
Thank you. So welcome to the first insurance discussion of 2019. Happy New Year. This month we are going to continue with the topics that have been previously overviewed by you in October, and you can see in the cover note how we're progressing through those topics. In terms of next steps, I just wanted to remind you that we're expecting to complete discussing all these topics around the end of this quarter, with the aim of publishing an exposure draft around the end of the first half of this year. And we expect still that that should give us time to make sure that any proposed amendments to IFRS 17 could be finalised on a timely basis for an effective date of 1 January 2022, which is also going to be proposed in this exposure draft. So with that overview, I'll pass over to Hagit.
Yes. The first insurance paper of the year. So agenda paper 2A presents staff analysis and recommendation on the topic of acquisition cash flows for contract renewals outside the contract boundary. The concerns raised by some stakeholders is about the effect of applying IFRS 17 in some circumstances. They've noted that when the amount of a non-refundable commission entities pay for acquisition of newly issued contracts is higher than the entire premium, and future renewals are outside the contract boundaries, applying IFRS 17 could mean that a group of the newly issued contracts is onerous, even though the entity pays that commission with the expectation that there will be future renewals that will cover this cost. These stakeholders expressed concern that this is the accounting treatment does not reflect the substance or the economic substance of the transaction as they see it. And they also state that the requirements in IFRS 17 would result in inconsistent outcome to applying IFRS 15 in similar circumstances, because IFRS 15 allows the allocation or requires the allocation of acquisition cost considering expected future renewals of contracts. Considering all that, the staff recommend that the board should amend IFRS 17 to address these concerns. The way that we propose to go ahead is first to require the allocation of any anticipated part of the insurance acquisition cash flows to any anticipated contract renewals that the cost relates to. Then we propose to require the recognition of an asset to that amount, and that asset will wait there until the future contracts will be recognized. In that period of time, there would be an impairment test that will be based on fulfillment cash flows. If there is not enough fulfillment cash flows to recover those costs, we will see loss, and of course a reversal of a loss if circumstances are changing. The staff think that the proposed amendment meet the criteria. It could provide useful information to users of financial statements, and it may not unduly disrupt implementation, because the way that we propose to do things is quite consistent with the concept underlying IFRS 17. And I hand over to the board to discuss.
Thank you. I think I can agree, but before making a judgment, help me understand your proposal correctly. So there is an example in the paragraph 14, which says CSM is 195. This is the net amount of simple calculation of CSM 285 minus acquisition cash flow 90. So in the end, CSM is 195.
Yes.
The benefit of having this net amount is we don't need to have an impairment test.
Yes.
That's the benefit of this. So therefore, we assume, including acquisition cash flow, no matter what the cash flow is all about, that is the part of the cash flow of contractual service margin. But your proposal says we have to allocate out of this 90, say for example, 40 goes to the renewal of other contract out of the contract boundary. So eventually, acquisition cash flow for this contract would be reduced to 50.
Yeah.
So that makes the CSM amount larger to 245. So eventually it will change the amount of CSM of this current contract. So I understand for that contract, correct CSM is 245 rather than 195, because we over-deducted the future proportion. So in order to make it correct, you have to divide 90 into 50 and 40. That's understandable. My concern is abuse, because it will change the amount of CSM. So that means the amount of CSM is larger than the one before in the current IFRS 17. And then if you allocate a favorable way, then you can increase your CSM in order to make current contract profitable. And then how do you prevent those abuse? Because it's quite subjective, which is for renewal, which is for current contract. What is your thoughts?
So we included in the paper a paragraph that talks about whether we want to introduce further requirements to tell people exactly how to do that. And then we looked at the standard again, and there is a lot more cost than just acquisition cash flows, a lot of maintenance costs that you need to do an allocation of which, and we thought that we shouldn't provide more specific guidance to tell people how they do that. They need to apply what we've got in the standard, so they need to use the information that they have to make a sensible allocation. Mm. Other than that, it's just telling them exactly how much, and this is something that is, I don't think a standard setting process should be taken. So there is enough, I think, in the standard to allow them to make that judgment in an appropriate manner. And in the worst case, although this is not a solution, there is always the impairment test that need to capture any misallocation or abuse. So this is why I felt comfortable with that proposal.
Nick.
Thank you. Just a clarification. I think it's around paragraph 40 in terms of what happens at that moment when the future contracts are recognised. Does the asset that's been created start to be amortised, or does it then feed in part of the new insurance contract liability and is then part of the CSM calculation as would happen otherwise?
So the bit of that acquisition cash flows that we park as an asset relates to a contract that needs to be recognised in the future. Mm-hmm. Until then, it waits. We do the impairment testing. But the moment that the contracts are recognised, it feeds into the calculation that Tak just mentioned. It impacts the CSM and going forward.
And it's the same with any of the other pre-recognition controls already under 17, so it's not a new mechanism.
So it's consistent, and I like that consistency, and that it's the same model in that respect. I mean, on balance, I think I support the staff recommendation here. I recognise there is a trade-off in that this just brings some additional complexity and indeed complexity for the user, and that we have to understand the costs that are going on here, and, you know, we'll have impairment charges going through. But I think on balance, the amendments better reflect the underlying economics of the business, so I would support the staff recommendation.
I was thinking some of the things that Tak was thinking about, that really what the amendment will allow is for people to move an expense to a later period, avoiding a loss in the current period or increasing profit in that period. But I am convinced by the arguments that you present that one way of looking at this is about the better reflection of economics, as Nick has just said. I think it's possible to see this issue from two ways, the way it was in the existing standard, and then this is another way of looking at it. One concern could be that there is the possibility that Tak's referring to of manipulation, or it could just be error in expectations that is an issue. However, when I think about that, we have a lot of accounting that is using judgments and estimates, and expectations forms part of that. So we do have an established practice where we allow people to think about their expectations going forward, and that's in all sorts of standards and very much in IFRS 17, where we have to think about expectations. So I was comfortable with that, especially combined with your arguments that this is more aligned now with what we allow under IFRS 15. And I think that rounds out this picture. So I will be happy to support the proposal.
Dencha.
Thank you, Hans. I agree with staff's proposal, and also I agree with that the staff tried to introduce the impairment test to avoid any assets overstated. But I have two clarification, two suggestion. One is that the staff proposed that those acquisition cash flow will be allocated any anticipated contract renewals. The term any anticipated contract come from IFRS 15. I agree, try to align two standards together. But I'm thinking that whether we also need some sort of constraints on so-called any anticipated contract, not result in those contract renewals too broad. So I have one question, one suggestion is that try to have those wording consistent with IFRS 15, because IFRS 15 when said that anticipated contract, there is also another wording that those contracts should be those contracts the entity can specifically identify. So whether we could introduce those notions. If it's still not enough, I'm thinking that when the company assess those anticipated contract renewals, should based on those reasonable and supporting information available for those entity, then company can make a judgment whether those contracts can renewable or not. Then those acquisition cash flow can be allocated those renewals. And the second clarification with regard to scope of the acquisition cash flow, because based on the paragraph 10 of the paper said that those recurring commission that are expected to be paid to intermediary or if a particular policyholder continues to pay the premium within the boundary of the insurance contract. In my understanding, based on the paragraph B65H of the IFRS 17, those costs normally will be included in the policy administration and the maintenance cost, not acquisition cash flows. So I would like to stop. Can you clarify further whether why those costs will be included in the acquisition cash flows? Or if they are included in the acquisition cash flow, I think they should meet the definition of the insurance acquisition cash flow to make it clear further. Thank you.
So I can address both your questions. So for the first one, I think we can pick most of what you said in the drafting. The reason, I will explain, the reason that we used any is that because it can be multiple renewals that you consider. Sometimes the commission can be four times the premium. Mm-hmm. You consider multiple renewals, not just one, but we will look at the wording to see that it is clear when we draft the requirements. I don't think that we need to add another reasonable and supportable information. It's already there in the standard for all types of estimates that they do. It's there. It's a fundamental aspect. So it's not adding much, but I think that for your first comment, we can pick up things in drafting. For your second one, I will clarify. Sometimes commissions are structured a different way. If there is a recurring commission, it can still be an insurance acquisition cash flows if it meets the definition. If it doesn't, it's just maintenance. And in the last TRG, someone actually asked that specific question, and we clarified, yes, the fact that it's recurring does not mean that it can never be insurance acquisition cash flows. It can. So this is a way to acknowledge the scope or the possible scope. So I hope it helps.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Mary.
Three things that are comments about how to do this rather than whether to do this because I don't object to the staff recommendation. The first how to do this is, I think, the same point that Jing Zhao was just raising about, if you look at your summary, paragraph 2A, anticipated contract renewals. And, you know, Huggy, you and I chatted offline and before about this. While I see its origin in IFRS 15, I worry that it's a word that doesn't have a lot of guidance or explanation about what anticipated means in the context of 15. And given all the differences that you rightly identified in paragraph, 37 of this paper, about the differences between 15 and 17, I'm not sure that I'd expect everybody to feel compelled to read across experience and interpretation in 15 to 17. I think we have the right guidance, and it is the guidance that both you and Jing Zhao were referring to in, paragraph 33, I think it is, 33, in IFRS 17, about how you estimate future events, and albeit it's talking about the cash flows associated with them, I think we should look at that term anticipated again and replacing it with something that ties more directly to the language in that paragraph, so that we pick up that, so that we basically, it makes it more consistent with the rest of 17, and we're basically linking it to the expectation of, I'm not gonna try and do the words without looking at them, incorporating in an unbiased way reasonable and supportable information available. That, you know, that's the key phrase to me in terms of saying which renewals, you know, you should be thinking about. Then the second and third points I have, look at this point about renewals and also about your comment in summary paragraph 2C about how you do impairment. You say in 2C expected fulfillment cash flows, but I think we only mean fulfillment cash flows because fulfillment cash flows are an expected value, as discussed in that paragraph. It's important to me that when we're looking at this deferral of acquisition contracts, that we are looking at recovery only through renewals of those contracts. It's not any future business, either with those same contract holders or future business generally. And I think we have to bring that out both in our discussion about what are the estimated renewals and for the fulfillment cash flows, so that that's not just kind of, do you expect that you'll recover it through future business somehow?
Thank you.
Daryl?
So a couple of things. I think perhaps at the outset, I also agree with where staff have landed on this. I think that's the right outcome. On a couple of points, I agree on your answer on reasonable and supportable. I'm always worried about words like reasonable and supportable because if we feel the need to use them in the standard, it implies that in other places we're happy with unreasonable information. And I think the answer that you gave to Jinja might be a really important one to include in the basis somewhere, just to actually expect that most information should be reasonable and supportable. I had a question that arose out of Nick's question, and I didn't think about it until he actually asked the question. If the group of future contracts is identified as being onerous, so in other words, we've now identified that we're not going to recover that acquisition cost, is that an impairment charge, or is that a recognition of future onerous contracts? I'm not sure I know the answer, so maybe you can think about it through drafting.
I think it will trigger immediate recognition of a contract, so the cost will go anyway. Classification may be something to think about, but they will go anyway.
Okay. And then the other thing that I spent quite a lot of time thinking about with this was around the impairment test, because I think that's the new thing in this whole exercise for me. And I know we've... as with most of our other things, received quite a lot of correspondence on this one. Well, quite a lot of correspondence generally, mostly supportive of the direction we're taking, but with a couple of different ideas on how we might think about the impairment test. And I've kind of trying to figure out what the different ideas are. And I think one is that we recognize a write-off the instant your expectations about renewals are not met. I don't think that's an acceptable approach, because what it'll mean is that sometimes you'll be showing a cost in the income statement, even when you actually expect the contracts themselves will still be profitable. So, for example, I've just dropped from 50% to 40% renewal rate, but that's still more than enough to recover my acquisition costs. So I don't think that's an appropriate answer. I know that I see that a couple of people seem to be suggesting the same sort of facts and circumstances test that we have for the normal process, but I don't think that flies either, because we're now dealing with a much longer period. So I sort of don't think that works. And then the third one that I see is being suggested is what I'd refer to as a dynamic allocation. So you constantly adjust the allocation of acquisition costs depending on your expectations of renewals. That just sounds like it's adding a whole lot more complexity. So I think there have been some good ideas suggested, but I think I'm fairly comfortable none of those ideas really is better than where we're heading with this paper.
And one observation in terms of complexity, we do have in the PAA for those simple contracts an option to recognize immediately all acquisition cash flow. So if people think this is complex and they prefer to use that simplified option, it's always available for those types of contracts.
Sure.
I should also start first saying that I agree with the staff recommendations, and I think just a few comments that maybe we could think about for perhaps a basis. The first is that I think that it's important to me, at least, that I think IFRS 17 today did provide useful information in the sense that there was truly a distinction that we saw between situations where, for example, the commission was refundable if there wasn't renewals and situations where it was not. And so it's not like it was a sort of lacking thinking, if you like, behind the current requirements. And I think it's also important to emphasise that just because people looked across and said that there was a difference in 15 doesn't mean that that would automatically mean that we should say, oh, 17's wrong and therefore we need to do something. So I think the sort of background matters to me. Having said all of that, particularly I think in a model which is based so heavily on estimations, having this approach which looks at expectations of future renewals feels like it fits relatively naturally as an amendment to the standard. So I agree with what you're proposing here. I can see why people think that it may help them better depict the economics as they see it, so I'm supportive of it in that respect. And I think it's good that you're proposing to do this in a way which sort of maximises the use of the current structure and concepts that we've got in 17 to reduce the amount of new thinking and disruption that we're potentially introducing into the standard.
Thank you.
I understand where this proposal is coming from, given the analogy with IFRS 15, but my opinion is that we generally capitalize too many expenses in IFRS. We're talking about recoverable amount. These expenses can never be recovered, otherwise they would have been in they could have even been capitalized in the original proposal. So this is money out of the window. And I think this proposal, yeah, it's basically a matching proposal. Having said that, I understand where we have landed, but I don't think it's very pretty. I think there was a lot to be said for the original proposal. Okay, can I see who supports the staff's recommendation?
13, 13, you're the votes. Okay, so next up is Agenda Paper 2B, which discusses the accounting for reinsurance contracts held when the underlying insurance contracts are onerous. Applying IFRS 17, reinsurance contracts held are accounted for separately to the underlying insurance contracts. However, to resolve an accounting mismatch, IFRS 17 includes an exception in the measurement of the reinsurance contracts held when changes in cash flows arise from changes in underlying contracts that are onerous. Some stakeholders think that the scope of that existing exception is too narrow, because it applies when a group of insurance contracts becomes onerous after initial recognition, but it doesn't apply when the insurance contracts are onerous on initial recognition. In this paper, the staff recommend that the board amend IFRS 17 to expand the scope of the existing exception to require an entity to recognise a gain in profit or loss when it's recognising the loss on the onerous underlying contracts, to the extent that a reinsurance contract covers the losses of each contract on a proportionate basis. And that expanded exception would also apply when the entity is measuring contracts using the premium allocation approach. Since the paper was posted, some stakeholders have reached out to staff to get a bit of better understanding about what we mean when we have proportionate reinsurance in the paper and why we've limited the scope of our recommendation in that way. So before I hand over to the board, I'll just spend a little bit of time talking about those points. In the example that we've included, and those examples are in Agenda Paper 2C, the loss that's on initial recognition of the onerous contracts is simply the residual of just two types of cash flows, premiums and claims. And also in those examples, the premiums and claims in the reinsurance contract are both proportionate to those in the insurance contract. That means that in the examples we've provided, you can see that there is a direct link between the initial loss on the onerous contracts and the cash flows in the reinsurance contract. And so there is an identifiable accounting mismatch there. In many real-life examples, some cash flows that are in the initial measurement of the onerous contract do not have a direct link to the cash flows in the reinsurance contract. As an example, some of the claims might not be covered by the reinsurer on a proportionate basis. And so in many circumstances, when an entity first recognises an onerous contract, it's not possible to see directly the extent that a reinsurance contract held covers the losses on that contract. And that means it's not possible to identify the extent that there's an accounting mismatch. However, the staff do think that when the reinsurer covers the claims of each contract on a proportionate basis, so as an example, by agreeing to cover 50% of any claims that the insurer will incur, which was what we've shown in our examples, it is possible to identify a direct link between the initial loss on the onerous contract and the cash flows that are in the reinsurance contract, by essentially requiring the entity to assume that it's the claims that have caused that contract to be onerous. And so that is why the recommendation in this paper applies only when reinsurance contracts cover claims on a proportionate basis. So with that, I'd now like to pass over to the board to discuss this paper.
Madam.
Thanks, Hans. First, thank you for the paper, staff's papers. In this aspect is are generally very comprehensive. I have just a few comments, so they may be questions. And I apologize in advance because after this, I don't have any brilliant alternative. So I'll leave that to you then. And I'll go straight to the recommendation. And I think I have one point that you might have a way to overcome this. Is what proportionate means. So I went back to IFRS 17 to look at the concept of proportionate, and so it's not a concept defined in Appendix A of the standard. We talk about proportionate coverage in paragraph 62A. It's the only point where I found. Then in the base for conclusion, we have two paragraphs, 304, I guess, and 305, where we talk a little bit. But even there, I don't think I was not totally comfortable that I would understand proportionate in the same way that is expected to be represented here. So I had a look in this concept in IFRS literature in general, and we use proportionate in many other standards, IS-36, IFRS-11, 33, IFRIC, 6, we use proportionately. The only one that where I found an example of what proportionate means was in IFRIC 6, where they say, when they talk about liability arising from participating in a specific market in terms of waste, electrical, and electronic equipment, we say contribute to costs proportionately. And e.g., in proportion to their respective share of the market by type of equipment. Of course, this. So I was really. This is, I think, it's a comment or suggestion to really think on how we are going to let this very, very clear by what we mean by proportionate in this particular standard. So we talked, and I accept that. And I totally agree with the arguments in the previous papers. This, to me, is a very principle-based standard. Loads of expectation, judgments, estimates involved. It's an entity-specific. So, and we do require reasonable and supportive information. I guess it's just really for you to think about how to make it clearer. Maybe in the amendment straight, in this bring something more to the standard itself, or beefing up a little bit the base for conclusion on this. So this was my main issue. I do agree with the objective of the paper itself, but that was this word made me think a little bit more. On the recognition, I guess, I found interesting that in the previous paper 2A, this is another general comment, you concluded the paper making reference to the two aspects of our decision to propose amendments in 43 A and B, paper 2A, you mentioned again that could provide useful information and might not unduly disrupt. So you didn't mention anything here, and I started thinking about in terms of the recognition and day one gain and day one loss to not netting, we are recognizing. So is this going to eventually disrupt the application? Because this will go to CSM, right? So what's your assessment? Or can we be comfortable that the two elements that we asked you to consider were, I am sure they were considered, but since you didn't mention, just to reconfirm that you consider, and how is your assessment of this?
Oh yeah, so we did actually note in the paper that there is a chance with this one. It does seem like quite a sizable amendment to make, and so we did note that there is a chance this one could actually disrupt implementation. But in paragraph 66 of the paper, we looked on balance at that disruption to see if it is undue. And what we noted is that actually many stakeholders think that there's going to be a benefit of the information that would be provided by this amendment. So we think that in this case, it is justified for this amendment.
And about the proportionate, you're going to think about?
Yeah, we can look at the words.
I think you're right, Amaro, in the sense that the fact that we're making such a difference to the measurement based on proportionate, it puts more pressure on that word. And I think we'll look at what's the best way to do it, whether we can do it by more description of what we mean by proportion, either on the standard basis or perhaps even add a definition within Appendix A itself. I think that's a fair comment.
Yeah, and even, like you said, if proportionate is used different in different industries, but also it can be used differently across the insurance industry itself, so it is important.
But what we mean here is that the reimbursement is proportionate to the claims incurred.
Yeah.
Jungwoo.
Thank you. Might be related to Amaro's comment on proportion. So I agree with your recommendation. Just a clarification to our stakeholders of our proposal here. So just I'm wondering the base or unit, when you ask to evaluate the proportion. So based on our recommendation, it's quite clear we are using just a one contract and contract basis, right? We don't use any components of one insurance contract at all. So our unit is a contract, the whole contract for the estimating proportion. Is that right?
Yeah, so the accounting mismatch that stakeholders have said to us is on and the initial recognition of a contract. So when a contract is first recognized and adds into a group of onerous contracts, so it would be providing proportionate coverage on that contract that the loss has been recognized for.
Okay, that's a clear answer. But there are some good explanation. Your paper is very nice, you know, providing all kind of analysis based on all cases, so very impressive. So, but if you see the paragraph 60 of the paper, in the case of a net cost position, the last sentence of paragraph 60, this kind of adjustment, you know, reducing the cost by this reinsurance, maybe some reinsurance contract, is essentially giving up some of its profit on profitable contracts. Basically, the onerous contracts and profitable contracts are not related at all, right? For this estimating some proportion, right?
So maybe I can add. So what we are saying here, we are not telling you that in the situation that you have a net cost on the reinsurance, go ahead and split the reinsurance contract to two separate contracts and do separate estimates and everything. We are still looking at the reinsurance contract as a single contract. We attribute some of the amount that it is the cost to recover that onerous loss that we have, but everything else is part of the CSM remaining for that single reinsurance contract to continue. So we are managing this as a single contract. We do not unbundle or play with the numbers. Is that what you were referring to?
If that's your answer, you know, just we are basing on the one single whole country rather than classifying what the categorized componentizing. That's not what we would like to ask our preparers, right? So based on our recommendation, the recommendation is based on the one whole insurance contract.
One reinsurance contract stays one reinsurance contract.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is this kind of explanation might give some kind of misunderstanding to our stakeholders. That's why I'm saying we need to be clear.
You're in the wording, okay.
Right.
I agree with the staff recommendations in this paper. I just wanted to make a couple of observations. One is that I think that I think it's a very, an example, if the board agrees to do it, of us being fairly pragmatic, if you like, in terms of trying to both deal with the accounting mismatch, but also, in particular for me, the proposed approach to how we measure how the corresponding gain is measured, the fact that we're being relatively simplistic, if you like, and I think generous, in saying that even though we know that the measurement of the underlying insurance contract is not just affected by premiums and expectations of claims, but things like acquisition costs, blah, 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 all of which affect the amount of the loss, we'll just say, based on the portion that you cover, take X percent of that amount and we'll call that the gain, which is not particularly scientific. It's sort of, I think, quite kind and quite practical. But I think we should make a point that we're being fairly pragmatic. And I think that matters particularly because, based on the examples in particular that I've seen from industry, it addresses the question that's been raised with us. I know some people now are raising broad effect patterns, in particular the non-proportionate types of cases, but for me, having such a simplistic approach to measurement would be very hard to expand to that broader population because it becomes a much more complicated concept than just covering 50% if you're covering particular types of losses or losses above a particular amount. And also, I think there's a big difference for me in terms of the logic between saying I've got a situation where for every dollar of claims that comes in, I'm covering 50 cents, versus a situation where it's particular types of claims I'm covering or amounts above X. Because if I'm covering all claims above 100 million, when I'm writing a contract for 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, how much of that is covered by the reinsurance or not? It becomes much more tricky to start thinking about. So I think we need to emphasise the pragmatism, the fact that it's addressing the main situations that were covered and that we're bringing practical. Also, just a sort of observation, but also a wording suggestion. I agree with the staff's proposal that this be limited to situations where the reinsurance contract was already in place or was entered into at the same time as the underlying insurance contract. I wouldn't overdo the accounting opportunities of a subsequent recognition, even though I agree with it. For me, the more fundamental point is you would have already booked the loss that caused the mismatch, so coming along later is not really addressing the issue, and that for me is more compelling. But also in the wording on the question that we're being asked to vote on, because you're using the words, the reinsurance covered held covers the losses, I'm presuming that's sort of code for the reinsurance is already in place or there at the time, but I think it's quite subtle, yep. Unless you're a geek. So let's make sure that if we're going to put this out for exposure, that people understand that that's what those words mean.
Yep.
But I agree.
Martin.
Yeah, similar to what Sue has said, because man, in paragraph 56, man, you're saying really that maybe not the only reason why maybe the underlying contracts are some onerous are the claims. Maybe it is okay cash flows, acquisition cash flows. Maybe is they have charged maybe not sufficient premiums, so it can be different reasons. So it is not only, I think, a kind of, in all cases, an accounting mismatch, because it could also have different reasons, different cash flows, and therefore is not covered by reinsurance. So we are, I think, coming up with a practical solution, because my understanding is we're not looking at premiums. They don't have to be proportioned. It's only the claims. So that is when people prior to that, okay, talk to me, then they always use this argument, okay, the premiums and the claims are proportionate, and then I was convinced more. Here, I think covering more cases where it cannot only be an accounting, it can also be an economic mismatch. So I think we are very practical in doing so, and I want to emphasize that. But my question is also, when we now proposing, okay, that we would book a gain on the reinsurance but not defer a loss, why do we use this approach and not really deferring the loss? Is there a specific reason for that?
Well, we account separately for insurance contract that we issue and reinsurance contract that we held. There is no support for deferring losses on contracts that you issued. Our model is built this way that it provides timely recognition for losses. So we have not considered changing the accounting for underlying contract. This is a fundamental aspect of the requirements. We are considering making amendments that are limited in scope but very meaningful to the concerns that have been raised. So we did not touch the underlying contracts.
Okay, man, overall I support, but I think it is coming up with a practical solution, and we're hearing already people are asking, well, why not more, why not, okay, insurance which is not proportionate. I think we can also consider that, but I think it would make the whole approach very, very difficult, because people also tell to me it's like hedge accounting. But in hedge accounting, we have clearly to demonstrate an offset between the underlying and between the, and here it is kind of quite different, because there are different elements, different kind of cash flows. And then we have to really to eliminate, okay, the other cash flows and concentrate only which is really then hedged, and which would make it a complex and difficult approach. And then we have the issue of what we discussed, okay, unduly disrupt implementation and all this kind of thing. So I would say, okay, I agree, but it is a really practical approach, which I think, okay, is the right thing to do now. But if you go further, I think it would be very, very difficult to do.
To paraphrase Sue, count your blessings.
Thanks, Hans.
Thank you. Actually, similar point. Question is whether or not we change the underlying concept of reinsurance, or is it just a simple exception? I think we are saying that under reinsurance contract is an independent, separate contract, independent from underlying contract. That is the basic idea. And that we already have exception in IFRS 17, which is when we make a change of estimate, which is onerous, then you can recognize gains in the reinsurance contract. So we are going to expand that exception. Then I think, but there is a big difference between the estimation change and the contract at inception, because estimation change, in the case of estimation change, the contract is already there, it's already working. But if you recognize gains on the at the inception, that is a day one gain. So recognizing day one gain before you receive the services. So there is a conceptual differences between the estimation change and the contract at inception. However, we are going to touch on the at inception basis. So that means we may be saying that it is not the case for, in particular, a contract that is not quite independent each other. It's dependent on the underlying contract. So you are saying that even if you recognize gain, day one gain, but you recognize day one losses at the same time. So therefore, this is just offsetting these losses for day one loss. So it's not day one gain. So that is the argument you are making. But on the other hand, you are losing the concept that the reinsurance contract is an independent contract. So it's a kind of trade-off. So we have to notice we are making such kind of trade-off in this paper. However, we have to ring-fence. This is only in the very specific particular situation, which what you are saying, the proportionate basis. So therefore, as Amaro pointed out, to define what the proportionate is all about is really important for this paper, and that we are not going to change our concept, but we are just create some exception, which is quite limited cases. So that is the point. And having said that, I agree with your staff recommendation.
Daryl.
So picking up on a couple of other points first, I think Amaro is right that the definition of proportionate really matters here. I think it is. I think, Laura, in your tee-up, you mentioned that you had responded to some, and I think that form, that or you were responding to some of the questions we had heard in terms of how proportionate should be thought about. I think that forms the basis of what we should be doing, but I think it is important to the comments others have made. I strongly support the idea that the exception is on the reinsurance side, not an exception on the primary contract side. And there's a couple of reasons for that. We've already rejected in the last couple of sessions in December anything that would result in changes to the valuation of the primary contracts, because we've said that is sacrosanct. We want to keep that basis consistent throughout. And I think it's important to remember almost the way the relationship between insurance and reinsurance works. Insurance can exist without reinsurance. Reinsurance can only exist if there's insurance. So it is the reinsurance contract that creates the link. And so that I think is what makes it important that be where the adjustment happens. I agree with the comments that Sue made, that I think this proposal goes a long way to addressing the identified concerns that we've heard a lot about. I think it's a very nifty way of dealing with it. I think I also agree with the reasons why we have established why we needed to change our mind. What has changed in the fact set? And primarily it's about this rareness of the expectations. I agree too, I think, with Sue's comments that the rationale that we're applying here does not flow through to non-proportionate. And it's because of this direct linkage that we're establishing. And just to sort of remember that, I guess, for non-proportionate after initial recognition, you can recognize the corresponding entry, and that's because you can make the linkage between the changes in cash flows for the same circumstance. So it seems to me that's fine. It is just in this at initial recognition circumstance. And then I think to somebody raised the question around disruption, I think pretty much what we've heard from a lot of insurers is this is a number they already spend a lot of time looking at. It's a number that they already spend a lot of time reporting internally at. On. So I think in balancing that, what is undue disruption, I think we know this is something that's already a focus of attention that suggests the information is there.
And in addition, the exception that we already have has similar mechanics. So I assume systems should be or have been developed in that direction. I don't know.
In fact, that's a fair comment. I suspect it may even be an easing of the requirements because up until now, they would have had to identify between those changes that arose because of new contracts and those that arose because of existing. Now they simply look at the group, and it's the changes that arise in the group.
Mary?
It's easier for me to echo than try and express myself the comments that Daryl made about the importance of not changing the accounting for the underlying contract. And I thought it was very important that the staff strongly supported the staff recommendation to reject the loss deferral approach that's in here. And I'm making this comment, I can't think of whether it was this paper or another paper about reinsurance. One of the other suggestions had been, in essence, some kind of derecognition on the basis of reinsurance. I think it was the other reinsurance paper. And I think also, well, this acknowledges that, again, as Daryl put it very well, you can't have reinsurance without underlying, and so there is a link. It is not a derecognition event because it is, and you do need to show them gross because it is the entity, the issuer who might cede some of that. It is the issuer who has the obligation to the contract holder. And so those are very important anchors to me that we are keeping even with the proposal here. A couple of other things is I think I hate to suggest adding examples, but I think illustrating that calculation, that, you know, that practical calculation that Sue was referring to explain where it comes in is important to make sure that everybody understands what we mean by that practical expedient. It can be simple, but I think it should be illustrated. And I think, you comment, I think it's paragraph 60 of this paper, that fundamentally, what we're saying is debit CSM, credit P&L, the consequence being you're going to record a higher cost in later periods for, you know, the reinsurance contract held. And, you know, I think one of the things we'll have to think about is the extent of user interest in understanding the buildup of higher cost for reinsurance in future periods. I guess one thing to think about is whether the reconciliation of changes in CSM that is a required disclosure will highlight how much current period loss offset has led to, you know, changes in the CSM that will increase future period cost or not. And again, setting out what our expectations are, maybe it's only based on current disclosure requirements rather than layering on disclosure requirements for visibility of what's going to impact reported profit margins in future periods.
Anne?
I think the question before us is whether an expansion of an existing exemption is justified and then how wide that expansion will be. So we've been talking about this underlying exemption and people that obviously was examined in depth and accepted and is part of the standard. And so what I've heard people say is speaking in favour of making this expansion, and it seems that this is because we have new information that we didn't have before and that you've got in the paper, and Daryl mentioned that. So there's more evidence now that justifies the expansion. And I think that it's good that we are able to do that within the model. So we're still staying with the principles that have been set up in IFRS 17. I think the effect will bring practice closer to what existed before IFRS 17, which is possibly why the preparers are asking for this, because it brings it more in line with what they did before, so favourable to them when they thought about insurance contracts and reinsurance as one thing rather than separately, which they're now required to do in 17. So I can hear a lot of agreement around that with good reasons. Then we still have the question, and also the rejection of the deferred loss approach. People have agreed that we wouldn't want to go there because it's too different to what we have. So the second part is then, you know, how wide it should be. And so that was what was missing in the paper that you've given us, but Laura's explained that, and I'm sure in the basis that you'll explain the difficulties of making the exemption wider than proportionate contracts, because you've explained to us why that now in this session, you've explained to us why there are limitations on how wide it can go. And Martin started to talk about that with the idea of hedging and the relationship, but then we'd have to think about effectiveness. And Sue gave us some examples as well of how difficult it would be to take this wider than whatever it is we mean by proportionate. So I think as long as we're setting out clearly our reasons, which I presume will be in the basis of why it needs to be constrained. So yes, we've extended the exemption, but it can only be extended so far. And although there seems to be some people who want it wider than that, we are lacking examples as to why they need it wider than that. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, can I see who supports the staff recommendations?
14.
Good.
So agenda paper 2C is just the examples for that paper, so we'll move on to agenda paper 2D. 2D also discusses the accounting for reinsurance contracts held. This paper is about when the underlying insurance contracts are accounted for applying the variable fee approach. So the paper discusses some stakeholder concerns that measuring a reinsurance contract held applying the general model when the underlying contracts are measured applying the variable fee approach may give rise to mismatches that they regard as being accounting mismatches. Some stakeholders have told us that the economic effect of some reinsurance arrangements is to transfer both the non-financial risk and financial risk from the entity to the reinsurer. Some stakeholders have suggested that the board amend IFRS 17 to permit an entity to choose to account for reinsurance contracts held applying the variable fee approach when the underlying contracts are accounted for applying the variable fee approach. Other stakeholders have suggested that the board amend IFRS 17 by expanding an existing risk mitigation exception that applies when an entity uses derivatives to mitigate financial risk, so that existing exception would also apply when an entity uses reinsurance contracts held to mitigate financial risk. The staff note that reinsurance contracts held cannot meet the criteria for the variable fee approach because there is no asset management service between the insurer and the reinsurer. The only asset management service is between the insurer and the underlying policyholders. In this paper, the staff recommend that the board amend IFRS 17 to expand the scope of the existing exception so that it applies when an entity uses a derivative or a reinsurance contract held to mitigate financial risk. And this is because the staff observe in the paper that that existing exception was introduced to solve an accounting mismatch for derivatives that is similar to the accounting mismatch that arises when a reinsurance contract held is used to mitigate financial risk. Okay, so I'd now like to hand over to the board to discuss this paper.
Thank you. I support your recommendation. In fact, I welcome the fact that you propose to eliminate those accounting mismatches as well. The only point I would like to make is that, in my view, the reasons we give to not consider the alternative, that is to make reinsurance contracts eligible to the viable fee approach, whether it's feasible by definition can be done, or whether it's a perception of ours. I mean, I think we really need to provide detailed reasoning that we follow there. It's not only our choice, it's just can't be done, or that really we are convincing that it's not just us deciding against it.
Any other comments? Can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
14.
That was quick.
If we move on to paper 2E, so this paper looks at the recognition of the contractual service margin in profit or loss in the general model. So the contractual service margin is the profit for a group of contracts, and it's recognised in profit or loss on the basis of coverage units, which, applying IFRS 17, are determined by considering the insurance coverage provided under the contracts in the group. You'll remember in June last year that you agreed an annual improvement amendment to the variable fee approach so that entities could consider investment-related services as well as insurance coverage when determining coverage units. And that's consistent with the depiction of variable fee contracts as providing substantially investment-related services. So this paper discusses whether any services in addition to insurance coverage should be considered when determining coverage units under the general model. Many stakeholders have expressed the view that for some contracts in the general model, the investment component and the return on the investment component is an important aspect of the contract. And they think that recognising profit on the basis of insurance coverage only does not provide useful information about their business activities. And they think this is particularly the case when the period in which the insurance coverage is provided differs from the period in which an investment component is generating a return for the policyholder. So the staff think that some contracts in the general model do provide a service related to that investment component. And in this paper, we've labelled that service an investment return service. I think it's important to note that we think this service is different from the investment-related service provided by contracts that meet the criteria of applying the variable fee approach. Those criteria identify contracts that provide the equivalent of an asset management service. The entity is regarded as managing assets on behalf of the policyholder in return for a variable fee. And as discussed at the December board meeting, we don't think we should change the criteria for identifying those contracts. We think an investment return service exists in some contracts in the general model when an entity provides a policyholder with access to a return that it would not otherwise be available to the policyholder. We think that such a service can exist only when the contract includes an investment component, but we don't think that it always exists when there's an investment component. For example, a no-claims bonus that a policy receives, you know, at the end of a contract if it hasn't made any claims probably does not involve the entity in providing an investment return service. The policyholder probably does not regard that as an investment that generates returns. We considered whether we could set criteria for when such an investment return service exists. However, we weren't able to identify, you know, hard set criteria that would always apply. For example, simply returning a no-claims bonus of a fixed amount probably doesn't provide a service. But in some circumstances, providing a fixed return of 0%, so again, just returning an amount of money, it could require substantial service. So we think this has to be a matter of judgment for the entity. We concluded that including an investment return service in the determination of coverage units, therefore involves a balance between potentially more relevant information about the services being provided, but also more judgment, and that introduces greater subjectivity and potentially less comparability. We've received some feedback since the paper was posted. Most comments have been supportive of the paper. We've received some comments about the identification of an investment component in deferred annuity products, as discussed in paragraphs 33 and 34 of the paper. And we know there are also some submissions to the TRG that are related to this issue. We don't think that affects our conclusions that an investment service return can exist only when there is an investment component, but it might affect exactly which products have an investment component. One stakeholder also has expressed concern that the proposed amendment would severely disrupt their implementation of IFRS 17. We know that the contractual service margin is a key aspect of IFRS 17, and we think, therefore, we need to consider very carefully the effect of changes relating to the way that it is calculated and recognised in profit or loss. So as with the proposals on reinsurance contracts held, you know, we need to balance whether the potential improvements in information justify the potential disruption. In particular, for this proposed amendment, although there may be some disruption, for many entities want this because they think it is significant, and an amendment could significantly improve the information they provide. They may already have thought about this sort of allocation for variable fee products, and hence they may have systems or be developing systems that can accommodate it. And we also think that if they don't want this amendment, that may indicate that they don't actually think that they have a significant investment return service, and therefore they could conclude that they don't need to change what they're doing because their investment return service is minimal. We think this suggests that overall, for entities that this amendment is important, in general, entities will want to make the changes. Therefore, turning over to the questions for the board, if we could start by question one is the basic question, and then the questions following are about details of how we apply it. So if we could start with question one is, do you think you should amend IFRS 17 so in the general model, the contractual service margin should be allocated on the basis of coverage units that are determined by considering both insurance coverage and an investment return service, if any?
Amaru.
Thanks, Hans. Thank you for the tee up. Some aspects that I had in my mind, you already clarified, and that's very positive to me. And I must apologize again because I do not have a brilliant alternative to the comment I'm about to make. But I'm sure you might have a clarifying answer for me, or you might be more comfortable than me. So I think the key aspect to me here is, well, it's unfortunate to me when I read the concept of investment return services, I think the description of what we have already in IFRS 17 to characterize investment-related services would fit much more neatly in this. But we didn't have the idea before. So, and we have to have a new term if we are going to accept this. So I understand, and that's absolutely fine. I don't think it's wise for us to go and redo it, but to me it would be much better. But anyway, that's absolutely fine. And my main comment is for you to think about. I'm sure you are already thinking. You mentioned about judgment, all the aspects that we are talking about, and the subjectivity and thing. But when in paragraph 27, you somewhat characterize the key aspect, the key question, the investment return services, you use the word providing the policyholder with access to an investment. This concept is not very clear to me. Access to me, in principle, is apparently very, very subjective. Although I, again, accept its principles-based and everything. So this is the main point to me, because if access is considered or interpreted too broadly, this might really compromise maybe too much the comparability that you have already expressed as one of the concerns with the proposals. If I do have any excellent idea to overcome this, I don't. Really don't. But it's something that is in my mind.
Carol.
Okay. So a couple of things. It's quite hard to answer these questions in one without sort of thinking ahead or peeping ahead a little bit. So I will answer your first question by saying, yes, I do agree, but then there's going to be a few buts after that.
Okay.
So I do agree. I agree with a comment that Amara has made that thinking about what access actually means is difficult in the context of this. So let me start by saying I agree overall that there is an economic logic in certain circumstances to say that the insurance entity is offering a service to customers, both investment and insurance, even when the contract that they're looking at is primarily insurance, but that's the biggest part of it. You mentioned later on that, and I think this is something that we need to emphasize and would be a very important part of my saying yes to question one, that the way that we would think about whether or not a service exists is it's a judgment issue. An entity needs to apply their judgment. They need to look at the type of contract that they're looking at. And one of the things for me that would indicate whether a service exists is there something that the customer wants to pay for? Is there something that the customer is prepared to say, this is a added-on element that I like? And I think to an extent that answers your question on access. Am I getting something that I cannot get elsewhere? That's the type of thing that makes me think around the sort of access approach. So I think I need to have that judgment point in. I think the other thing that's really important is I think the restriction that is imposed by investment component. It is an existing definition within IFRS 17. It means that people are constrained in the extent to which they can apply this. They can, within that bigger pool, apply judgment to determine what that level is, but they are constrained in the ability to apply this judgment. And then I think the other thing that was really important for me in saying yes on this one was the way that you would think about the relative pricing of the two components. And a lot of that leads me to the way I think about disruption, but I'm not going to talk about that until we get to the end. But I think a lot of those factors mean that I give myself comfort that, firstly, this is economically sensible, and secondly, that a lot of these other things that are in here will reduce the effect of disruption without resulting in undue loss of information.
Sue? And also, I'm not sure I'm going to do a very good job of sticking to your rules and answering one question, not others, but I'll try and behave to the extent that I'm able. I've gone round and round in circles on this topic for months since it first came to the TRG, actually, in terms of whether we should do something here or not. And I think on balance, we should. And so I agree with the recommendation of the staff to try and address this area and sort of trying to point to what's the new piece of information that makes me think that we do need to look at this, which is different to what we had when we were dealing with 17 and its finalisation. I think the one that really brought this home to me is something we probably did need to think about were some of the examples that came up at the TRG where we had, you know, differences in duration between the period over which insurance cover and investments, whatever we're calling them.
Returns.
Stuff is provided. So we had a disconnect in duration and was it the most
representationally faithful depiction to only focus on insurance, and I think that's why, for me, I think we need to do something. Now, not sure here whether I'm going to stray into what I'm not allowed to or not, but what the heck. Where it gets complicated is in terms of how specific we can be about what this type of service is that we mean, and how do you do this analysis with sort of trying not to disrupt implementation more than we need to, but giving people enough guidance that we've got enough comparability, but allowing people to use judgment. And had lots of discussions with the staff of trying to come up with definitions and guidance and criteria. And on balance, I agree with where the staff has landed, because I think all we can do is give pointers. I think it's helpful to point to some sort of facts and circumstances to think about, like, would you charge differently with or without these types of services? What does the policyholder think they're getting? You know, some of these things. I think there will be circumstances where there's an investment component where personally I'd struggle to see that there is a service that would mean that I think you should identify an investment-related service and attach benefits to it. So, for example, if I just get 100 and I just have to give back 100, in some cases that might not require too much effort or work or service. And others, though, it might in some economic environment. So we can't even be black and white on stuff like that. So I think the custodial service is a good one, because I think I'm relatively comfortable that that's in itself not one. But we are going to need people to apply judgment. And what I think is important is that I think we're trying to get to a situation where we're enabling people, or we want people to really, on a sensible, to use a neutral word, sensible basis, stepping back and saying, do I think there's something going on here other than pure insurance service that means that it would give a better depiction of what's going on by identifying that service and thinking about that when I'm thinking about coverage units? And I think, in plain English, that's where I understand the staff is trying to go, and that's what we're shooting for. But I think we're going to need to be careful that we're not doing it in a way that people are going to be forced to do very granular analysis and be second-guessed by auditors, where so far they would have reasonably concluded that there's not really much going on over and above insurance coverage, and they've done all of their work in good faith and they've analysed on that basis. I don't think we want to upset that.
Yeah.
But we do want to make it possible where you really think that there's benefits and profit, etc., linked to something other than pure insurance, that you can and will separate that out and account for it. And on that can and will, and not just do you want to, I had one wording suggestion, and now I'm really misbehaving, which is on the wording on question three. And I was really pleased, actually, with some words that Daryl used, maybe in passing, but they were consistent with what I was thinking, which was, at the moment we say applied consistently in deciding whether to include an investment return service. I think perhaps
when
I would have meant applied consistently in deciding whether an investment return service exists.
Yeah.
So it's not do I want to include it, it's do I think it exists.
Yeah.
And those
yeah.
are the words that Daryl actually used.
Yeah. Mary?
I think Sue did better than me on playing within the rules of question one through six, because, you know, I'll start out by saying that I support the idea of looking at the identification of coverage units and whether or not there are circumstances in which there is some kind of investment service that should be considered in determining what the coverage units are and how they are used. And I think it is very important and I'm very supportive of the staff proposal to not expand the scope of the variable fee, because even though there are times when the direct contracts may look very, very similar to the ones that fall outside direct, I think there is a difference, and we drew the lines correctly in saying direct is when there's identified asset pool, and that's, you know, and that's a different service that's being delivered. So it's fundamental to me that we not start. I haven't seen anything that convinces me that or even makes me wonder if we drew the line in the wrong place. Yeah. So I think it's in the right place, and even if economic situations or other may compel those who have contracts that are similar to but not direct to pay returns from pools in a way that looks similar. They are different obligations of the entity, and I think support having different models. So it's very important to me that we're not messing with that, and that legitimately relates to question one. I start straying when I say my concern is that the proposal as drafted seems to me not strong enough in terms of making it a determination of what the facts are, as opposed to kind of the, are you seeking, you know, do you want to try and identify something? And while I agree that there's judgment, and I agree from the analysis that you've provided in the paper about the range of circumstances, that it really, especially at this point in time, given some of the overarching criteria that we have about not unduly delaying or disrupting implementation, that we cannot try and identify rigid criteria. I think we have to I think I would support this only if there were a clearer objective in terms of saying something along the lines of an entity needs to determine whether, and I don't know whether I call it material or substantive or significant, investment services that they believe, and this gets into the kind of the pricing, is a significant service in addition. And I'm not wedded to these soft words, these modifiers like substantive or significant, so don't emphasize those too much right now. But I think we have to set out, you have to determine whether there's something that's meaningful there. And if you do, then I think I would also want disclosure around what the basis is. And I think maybe that's required by the general IS1 significant judgments.
And IFRS 17
as well.
Yeah. And maybe that's a nice chorus of know your disclosure requirements. Chomp. thinking about whether we should be linking any kind of explanation of how general requirements apply, general disclosure requirements apply, to the transparency interchanges in the CSM that are required, because I think it has to be pulled together so that users can understand what the impacts of these judgments are, not just be somewhere there is a disclosure. Now, the place that I'm going to really stray out of bounds is I'm looking at question six and the wording there, and I bring it up now because it goes back to the, this is different from the variable fee approach. Mm-hmm. And question six is talking about, if we go this route, what costs do you include? And confirming, what paragraph is it? 45, that you include fees from asset management costs, 45, 46. My understanding is that the fees that you would include do not extend to gains and losses or gains and losses that are different from the returns you expected. So it is, we're talking about fulfillment cash flows, including outlays.
Yes, we're not talking about changes in value,
right.
Unexpected changes in value,
right.
Of the assets. But,
and I think we need to make that clear, because otherwise I think people may sincerely read this and thinking about what we did in the variable fee model, and saying, are we talking about investment return services, costs relating to cash flows relating to investment return services, including changes in value? And that's not what we're saying. This is not the variable fee with different debits and credits. It's a different model for those that are close, but not direct participation. Okay.
Anne.
My question was about disclosure, which Mary has just brought up. And you've explained that this is about moving the boundary for the coverage units, and so it means that it was simpler before deciding what was an investment, what was an insurance service, and what will go into this investment return service. So it's not as clear now, so it's more complicated. We know that the preparers will need more judgment, but the feedback you've had so far indicates that many of them are happy to take that on. So my question just related to the other side. You know, if this is now more complicated, does that mean for users things are more complicated as they try and understand the implications of this change? So is there sufficient disclosure? Mary referred to disclosure. Are there sufficient requirements to ensure that users can understand this as well as they could before making this change?
There is a lot of disclosure around the contractual service margin and how it's changing and how it is being recognised in profit or loss. So, you know, users will be able to see how the contractual service margin is developing and being recognised. And the requirements about having to disclose significant judgments and assumptions will mean that, you know, entities do have to give information about how they're making these allocations. They also, with the contractual service margin, you have to give an indication of how you expect the contractual service margin that is there at the balance sheet will be recognized in profit or loss in future periods. So there is a lot of information given. We don't have, of course, in IFRS 17 anything specific about, you know, relating to, is this insurance coverage, is this investment return services, because we didn't have that idea in IFRS 17. I mean, we are going to think about disclosures generally across the package of changes that we might make once we've decided what all those changes would be. So we can think about whether this change requires specific additional disclosures in order to help users. I mean, the other side from the user point of view is that I'm sure many stakeholders would argue we've made it better for users because we're giving a better depiction of how they are actually earning the profit in the contracts. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Gary.
Thank you. It, I thought a very good paper. Actually, all of the papers today were very good, and pretty much on board with the 8 recommendations that you've got here. But I was going to play by the rules and wait for question 3 to come up.
Well, no, I wouldn't.
Students to me and jumped onto it. I'll go on to question 3, and it's about judgment. And you know, you don't want to, not proposing objective or criteria, which. But as a generalist career preparer, I love to be given judgments, but I don't know that we can be just totally silent to say it's judgment. I mean, you're changing in concept, you might be changing the units and the basis of coverage and the amortization of the CSM into profit, you know, is what we're sort of talking about here. Anytime you start getting off the balance sheet and into profit, you know, minor amounts seem to get some attenuated attention in the world. So my recommendation would be fine to the way to develop it a little bit, even if it's not a great, could be in the basis. Because what happens, for example, if you very clearly have an investment-related service, but by most objective measures, the value would be inconsequential, but trivial, but it's there. Do you just ignore it? But then you'd say, well, I got one of these things. They're ignoring on the basis of materiality as opposed to value to the insured and so on. And you might have something that's remote, but if it manifests itself, it's large. You know, what's your judgment on that? So I'm loath to not develop it in some capacity or some broad-based boundaries again. Like some others, I don't necessarily have a suggestion how to do it, but to just say it's judgment, and then sue it here. You don't want to be down at, you're working in good faith, and you're confronted with a regulator and auditor on granularity and stuff like that. That's not what this is about. Either you're selling insurance, and that's what your marketing collaterals and your pricing collaterals talk about. And if in your, you don't really develop the investment return service in any consequential way, other than maybe say, oh, and by the way, if we do really good, we'll adjust your premiums 0.5% or something. We need some sort of development of it. And I'm happy to be in the basis, but I think being silent, I think it's just going to come back in comment letters.
Nick?
Thank you. I'm drifting to question five because I'm struggling to answer question one without getting into question five.
Okay.
So I'm very sympathetic to the staff's proposals here, but I'm also sympathetic to the concerns that Mary, Anne and Gary have expressed as well. And so as I see it, the proposals do have the potential to better depict the underlying economics that's going on here. And the very simple example where you have an investment return service that's running for many years after the insurance service has ended is a very obvious example. And so I think I sign up to that. But equally, the proposals provide the opportunity to stray away from the underlying economics because it's issues around the judgment and the subjectivity, and particularly the issues raised in question five in terms of assessing the relative weighting of those services. And I guess trying to get more comfort, I think this is what others have said around, you know, systematic and rational basis, whether how we can try and, if there's any way we can try and strengthen that or disclosures can help bring comfort to that. So I think my bottom line is that generally I'm happy to sign up to the staff proposal here, but with that concern in the back of my mind.
Thank
you. With regards to the question one, I suppose staff's recommendation. As Sue mentioned, that when I think the issue came out at the TRG meeting, when I first read those examples, especially for those, I think one of the examples is regard to the deferred annuity, when the insurance coverage period has significant difference from those investment, so-called investment return period, something like that. It's clear to me there is some investment service there. So I think to allocate those CSM to insurance coverage service as well as investment return service, I think will first of all represent the economics of those contracts. So I agree with the staff proposal, as Sue mentioned before. And secondly, actually, and also mentioned, many board members also mentioned with regard to the more judgment and more subjective, and also as Gary mentioned, question three, that whether we need to do something. First reaction when I touch this question, whether we really need some objective or guidance, because it's principle-based, and how to make judgment, how to allocate those CSM to those investment return services, actually is a very challenging job to the preparers. But when I think about that, because in practice, those insurance contracts, especially those insurance contracts have some components of investment return components, very, very various different forms, and it's very difficult to provide clear guidance with regard to this issue. So when I read the analysis, staff analysis, actually some of the analysis is really helpful. The analysis said that when entity should consider investment services only when those insurance contracts include an investment components. I think this is a good guidance, good net analysis. Secondly, if when the entity provide only, you know, custodial services, as Sue mentioned, or when the investment components include solely to facilitate insurance coverage, I think this guidance also, this analysis also very useful to make judgment. Thirdly, and those judgments should be applied consistently to similar contract. I think this kind of guidance also very useful. And also fourth, that those payments should not be relevant to those, you know, future policy holders. I think this guidance also relevant, useful. Finally, I think although the paper did not mention that, but applying a materiality principle, although materiality will apply all those standards, but maybe it's helpful for us to mention again, if those services or amounts is very small, minimum, not material. You do not necessarily allocate those CSM to those services. So I think, as Gary said, that maybe those were not provide guidance or objective in the standard itself, but those analyses could be included in the basis of the amendment to help the preparer, help the people to make judgment. I think that will be very helpful.
Sure. Anne, am I allowed to talk about question five?
Yes.
So I just wanted to touch on this point on the relative weightings of benefits and this idea of a systematic and rational basis. So I think in an ideal world, if I could put some boundaries, more boundaries around this and more specificity around it, it would make me feel more comfortable. But one of the things that I've had struggled with a little bit thinking through this issue is that I think we need to be careful of potential knock-on consequences for 17 overall, and also I think we need to be careful that when we're looking at a specific issue that we don't focus so much on so many different aspects of that, we end up risking having sort of a lack of proportion within IFRS 17 itself. So we already have a situation, as I understand it, that in 17 with VFA type contracts, but also just with general model contracts where there's different insurance coverage or where coverage changes over time,
yes,
people are having to make assessments about what that means for benefits, coverage units, etc. already.
Yes.
And I think we think now that they're doing that, hopefully on a systematic and rational basis, that's the sort of logic that we have in 17.
Yes.
And so this approach to me is proportionate internally in the sense of being consistent with the general approach that we've taken in 17. And also, I worry a little bit that if we sort of suddenly become obsessed about the guidance we need to get comfortable with this here, as soon as we start talking about things in this context, people will think, oh, that probably means we need to think about it over here in VFA. We need to think about it for the general model, just for insurance coverage. I think there's a risk of disruption and new thinking that seeps into other parts of 17 that is not helpful for people who are in the implementation phase. So even though it's with a little bit of wariness that I agree with this, I think it is the most appropriate approach given where we are that we've got to work with in 17 at the moment. I just wanted to touch specifically on this idea of materiality. Yeah. Personally, I think we shouldn't, I agree with the idea, but I'm not sure we should use the word materiality, because I think we're trying to use that where it's material to the financial statements as a whole type idea,
yeah,
and we shouldn't be using it inconsistently. But I think from memory in 9, we had something to do with something being small in size. I just had a quick look, I can't find the words, but we've got the idea of if something was de minimis, something like that would be capture the idea, but not using the word material, I think might be something we could look at.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we'll look at the guidance we can add, and when we do ballot it, you'll see it in the context of the whole of 17, so you can assess that proportionality as well.
Daryl?
So I agree with almost everything Sue just said. So I think it is proportional the way we've proposed doing it here. I think in particular we need to bear in mind that these judgment areas already exist in VFA. They already exist in general model between different types of insurance. I think that proportionality is really important. That said, I think I agree with a lot of what Jen Chao was saying about there's an awful lot of really good analysis in this paper. And if we can find a way to incorporate some of that analysis, I think it helps people think about the issues. And I think that thinking about the issues, I think, is very, very helpful. And then I agree completely with Sue on the material statement.
Mary?
Just going back to question 3 and the issue of how much judgment. Something that struck me listening to board members' comments is to go back again to IFRS 15. And IFRS, just in terms of providing a bit more about what constrains your judgment in terms of determining whether an investment return system as service exists. And that's the distinction that IFRS 15 makes when it's talking about identifying performance obligations between activities that deliver some good or service to a customer and activities that an entity must undertake to fulfill a contract, but such as setup costs. It's paragraph 25. And because I think there would be many instances in which an insurer would say, I have to manage in, you know, my investments, and the success of managing those investments will determine what resources I have to make discretionary payments to policyholders. But the fact that I may have costs and I have necessary activities connected with that doesn't automatically mean that I'm delivering an investment return service. And so without being prescriptive, I think that, you know, highlighting the kind of distinction that IFRS 15 makes between necessary activities and activities that deliver a good or service to a customer may be a helpful pointer. And I think it doesn't run afoul of what Sue was just talking about, because her comments were more providing guidance on one thing that then has reverb, but we're talking about something new here in the context of determining when you have this investment service. So that's something I point to as maybe, it doesn't say this is a clear line and this is and this isn't, but you have to think about factors like this.
Having heard the discussion and including the suggestions that have been made to the staff, are we comfortable to vote for all questions at one go? Or yeah?
Yes.
Then can I see who supports the staff recommendations?
13.
Okay. That's it, ma'am.
Thank you, everyone. We'll be back in 2 minutes.